Oh, man, I'm stoked to have Jack Baruge in here today. There's really nobody that I would like to seek out advice from, given the unprecedented nature of the fiscal and monetary experiment that we are engaging in this country. There's nobody I'd really rather take advice from or get the advice of than an old school floor trader. Okay, this guy, this is the closest I could get to Rick Santelli here on the podcast. He's old school. He spent a lot of time on the floor, and he is a no bullshit individual that's going to give us hopefully some no bullshit answers as to just how far past the point of no return our economy has gone. So I'm really interested. Happy to have Jack on today. First and foremost, I want to shout out my patrons and people that make the podcast possible, folks. If you enjoy the podcast, you can sign up on Patreon and donate a monthly recurring sum to help support us. That link is in the podcast description. But I want to shout out first and foremost those people that have made the podcast possible for so long. My friends over at JM Bullion, the only place I buy my gold and silver bullion. I love JM Bullion. They have incredible inventory, reasonable premiums to spot, meaning always affordable when compared to competition. They ship discreetly. They turn around my orders very quickly. I love JM Bullion. They've done over $7 billion in sales. They've been in business for over a decade now. They have established themselves as a reputable name in the gold and silver bullion business. And QTR podcast listeners can just email Laura directly. You can go on the website. You can order that way if you'd like. That link is in my podcast description. But if you've never ordered gold or silver bullion before, you want a personal touch to your orders, just email Laura, L-A-U-R-A, at jmbullion.com. That link is in my podcast description. And she would be happy to take care of you on a one-to-one basis. You have your own salesperson at JM Bullion, folks. What else could I give to you, huh? You have your own... Name me one place where you can dial a business on the phone and actually get a human being. The answer is you can't anymore. And I just went through a process with American Airlines that I could tell you about at some point, but it's a whole other podcast in and of itself. Just take my word for it. That's JM Bullion. This podcast also brought to you by my buddy George Gammon over at Rebel Capitalist Pro. George Gammon has teamed up with Lynn Alden, Chris McIntosh, and Brent Johnson to help you figure out ways to preserve your wealth in a world of out-of-control central banks. George runs two fantastic YouTube channels, Rebel Capitalist and George Gammon. He does live question and answer sessions, and George knows the plumbing of the central banking Ponzi scheme about as good as anybody out there. And the nice thing about George is he doesn't agree with me on everything, and that's why I'm stoked to have him on the podcast relatively soon. We're working on hashing out a date right now. But in the meantime, you get access to people like Lynn Alden and Brent Johnson, all of their premium research just from signing up for Rebel Capitalist Pro. You get access to the Rebel Capitalist Pro forums and mock portfolios, which I love perusing. Lots of great information from like-minded investors, all basically trying to figure the same thing out, which is what in God's name is going on. Rebel Capitalist Pro, well worth it. If you're interested, shoot George a message. Let him know that I sent you, that you want a free trial. You'd like to take it for a spin. His team, they're fantastic over there. They will work with you in getting you a trial of Rebel Capitalist Pro. And his YouTube channels are free to check out. And I think some of his live question and answer sessions are as well. So well worth it. Check out my friend George Gammon over at Rebel Capitalist Pro. Finally, this podcast brought to you by my newest sponsors, the wonderful people over at Swan Bitcoin. I've said it before and I'll say it again, probably the only Bitcoin sponsor I will ever have. Because if Bitcoin does what Swan thinks it's going to do, they're going to be replete with cash and I will be raising my rate by 1,000 times. And if Bitcoin doesn't go well, then... I'm not going to want to be hawking other Bitcoin products. So for better or for worse, Swan, I love you guys, and you're the one. So either it's going to go great or it's going to go not at all, but I'm stoked that you guys are supporting the podcast. Swan, I love. Look, I know people that are involved with Swan. My friends Lynn Alden and Larry Lepard, I know, are very close to the company. I've talked to the staff over there. putting aside the fact that I think Bitcoin has risk, although I do own Bitcoin as well, putting aside the general risk of Bitcoin, I believe Swan has a team that is trustworthy and honest in an industry of less than trustworthy and honest people. Swan is a great, simple app that helps you stack Bitcoin on a recurring basis. It's very simple. It's like did I fuck that up last podcast too? It's like the Ronco's Showtime Rotisserie Grill. You set it and you forget it. It's easy to use, and the user interface is nice and simple. And with Swan, they're giving you $10,000 worth of Bitcoin with no fees. So the first $10,000 that you buy, they're not charging any fees on at all. And basically, it's an app. You don't have to open it more than, you know, once a year if you don't want to. But you know it'll be there working for you in the background and stacking Bitcoin on a recurring basis the way that you set it up. I love the simplicity behind the Swan app. I like the staff there. I trust them. And if you use my link, which is in my podcast description as well, you get $10 in free Bitcoin. So pretty much a no-brainer there. If you're going to give it a try, you might as well use the link. I know, look, I'm Mr. Skeptical about referral links also too. Well, you know, 10% off. Aren't they doing that for everybody? Blah, 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 blah. Hey, if you're going to do it, give me a play and get the $10 in free Bitcoin. It'll get you off the ground. Get you off the ground from a place that isn't zero if you're going to start stacking. But the Swan app, easy to use, and I like the staff over there. So if you're going to do Bitcoin, do Swan. That's my advice. All right, fools. All right, happy to have with me today one of the legendary former floor traders back when there was floor trading. It was a long time ago. We'll tell you about it sometime. But now the chairman of SmartX Data, CNBC contributor for 25 years as well, and the former president of Commerce Bank, among a million other things, Mr. Jack Barugin. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing great, Chris. Always a pleasure being on your show.
Well, I got to say, it's been too long, and it's great to have you back on. I got a lot of people reaching out in the weeks and months after the last time you were on requesting that you become a regular, and I'm not sure why the hell we didn't do that. Maybe because I'm lazy in general and kind of fly by the seat of my pants with scheduling, but I'm glad that you're on now because first and foremost, you know, I wanted to get, look, we are in unprecedented territory when it comes to monetary policy and fiscal policy.
Oh, yeah.
And I know what all of the other CNBC contributors think about it. You know, I don't need to try to figure out what Tom Lee thinks or what Austin Goolsbee thinks or any of these other people. But I want to know what somebody who was on the floor for a long time, long enough to have been around before the modern monetary theory experiment, and really was at the nerve center of supply and demand and the basic economic laws of capitalism, what somebody like yourself thinks of the direction we're heading in. And you can take that question wherever the hell you want.
Well, you know, it's funny you asked it that way, because one of my biggest complaints on every one of these television broadcasts, television broadcasts, is the fact that they don't have people that take their own risk. You know, they've got people talking positions. Tom Lee talks his position. He is known as the ultra bull, the mega bull, whatever you want to call him. And, you know, for him to even say anything, you know, to the contrary would, you know, disrupt his brand. So, you know, but in the old days, you know, if you remember correctly, we were on the floor and we were not married to a position. We didn't have a dog in the fight. We traded the market we saw and not the one that we wanted. So going back to that and looking at the market now, it's obviously a sell rallies market. You know, people have been so conditioned to buy dips. Quite frankly, you know, it was forced upon us. You know, whether it be the Fed keeping money very, very loose, whether it be the fact that there was really nowhere else to go with it, whether there was no competition for capital, all of that added up to a market condition that was almost, if you think about it, obscene. You know, it almost feels, and this is the analogy that we used to use on the floor of the exchange, and I want your listeners to think about this. We used to call it the big sucking noise, all right? You'd hear people getting sucked into positions, all right, on the floor of the exchange. They'd all be coming in doing the same thing, and then bam, they'd all of a sudden see the market correct. Now, you know, I've watched the market correct 20, 30% many, many times in my life. But think about it this way. If we see a 30% correction now, that is 1,500 S&P points. That is more than people have ever seen in their lives. It's going to be earth-shattering for a lot of people. And so I guess what I'm really telling people is, and what I'm saying to you is, the market's correcting. Get ready for it. I think this has only begun. And if we're right, you know, it might not happen until maybe after the election, but it's going to happen. Everybody over the age of 50 knows we've got a 20 to 30% correction coming. It's a question of when. And because of that, over the course of these last few months, look, if you were smart enough, you sold into these rallies. You were able, because the Fed is telling you that they are now pulling back. See, all of the reasons people have been getting bullish, all of the reasons people have been getting into what Chairman Greenspan used to call the irrational exuberance, is because of the Fed. The Fed has done this. They are the culprit. They're the ones who told us that inflation was transitory when it wasn't. They're the ones now that started to tell us that they were going to start cutting rates when, and now they can't. See, it's they are the ones that have caused this problem, Chris, and they continue to cause it.
So I just honestly, that may be the most amount of questions I wrote down from 2 minutes of somebody talking ever. And I don't even usually take notes, but I just filled a page of things I want to ask you. Let's just start with the psychological conditioning of markets. One of the first things that you alluded to there was the fact that the Fed was basically forcing liquidity down people's throats. But, you know, this has been going on since 2008. Is that, yeah. you could argue as far back as 2000, but let's just say 2008. So you're talking about, you know, we started hiking 2 years ago. You're talking about 14 years of the Fed forcing people with low rates and unlimited liquidity to take on debt and get long. Obviously, I want to know how big the catastrophe is going to be. I mean, you're talking about a 20% correction. Like, okay, but we've never really been down the road where we have invested this much for this long. But then talk about the psychological element, and this is something I write about all the time, which is if you've conditioned investors, there's people in this industry that have been working in finance now for 10 years, Jack, that have never seen a bear market. You know,
they've never,
I mean, with the exception of March 2020, which showed up basically as a blip on the radar before the market doubled, there's never been an instance where buying the dip hasn't worked over the last 20 years. And so what is it going to do? I mean, I feel like changing the mindset and the psychology of the market is like a turning around a giant ship. You can't just do it at once. And what's going to be the breaking point that makes people realize what you're saying, which is things are different now? I feel like they're just going to have to beat people senseless with it, and we're not even close to that yet.
Well, no, you're right, because there are still way too many people that are convinced that this little 5% pullback is a blip. It's nothing more than a hiccup. You know, I've had half a dozen people at least tell me that it's an election year. There's no way they'll let the market break. You know, but the reality is this: if anybody wants to really know what's going on, I would suggest reading Nassim Taleb's book, Black Swan. Because it basically talks about it. Now, he was a man who was a trader at First Boston. I don't know if you know Nassim's story, because I used to handle him on the floor. Then he was an options trader in the pit, and he went broke. This is one of the most brilliant minds on Wall Street, and he went broke as a floor trader. He got off the floor, and he ended up making billions of dollars. What took him down was a black swan, something that came out of nowhere that he did not expect, and that's exactly what we could see happening. Now, could it be something that we've already seen the beginnings of? Maybe it's commercial real estate. You know, I mean, I'm looking at properties that are in California. Look, in San Francisco, office buildings are going for 10 cents on the dollar. That's insane to me. Some bank is holding that paper. Somebody is going to have to take that write down. Eventually, all of this short-dated, cheap money will come back to bite everybody on their ass because it was artificially low. And yes, you're right. It started in 08 and it never really changed. They've debased the U.S. currency along with other global currencies all the way on through. And how do I know that? Look at gold. Mm-hmm. Look at gold, because that tells you exactly what has happened to the U.S. dollar over the course of the last 15 years.
Well, being a – man, I got a couple more questions, but let's just stay on gold for 1 second. Being a former floor trader, where you guys really I would say that you're dialed into the nerve center of sentiment in a way that people can't get from sitting behind a computer screen, obviously, when you're sitting there and you're feeling the excitement and – or the disappointment, and you really are kind of, it seems like a place where the trend is your friend really can sometimes be like the lay of the land. What do you make about the way gold has moved over the last 6 months? Because I feel like people say, okay, well, it's a technical breakout. You know, it's through 2000 and through all-time highs with authority, but I really feel like it's a breathtaking move. I think it could be the beginning of, if you look at a chart, if you're a chartist, I'm not, but let's just say, you know, when you cross the Rubicon of going past all-time highs with some gusto, that's usually an indicator that there's a lot of new buying interest. But just to rally, you know, $400 an ounce in 3 or 4 months with no real breathing room, and it has decoupled from rates. So if you look at gold versus real rates over the last 20 years, 2 years ago, something happened where gold just stopped tracking real rates, which it has done for 20 years. Now, when you see a trend like that break and the move that we've had here in the metal, what would your sentiment be? What would the sentiment be from guys down in the pit right now?
Well, the first thing that people would say is it's more than technical. And, you know, like I remember my old mentor would say, I'd say, you know, hey, it's breaking out of this price. And he'd be saying to me, why? Find out why. Someone has to be buying it for a reason. All right. Are they short? Are they covering shorts? Are they getting long? So fundamentally, something has shifted in these last few months in the gold market. If you notice, central bank buying has never been this strong before. All of a sudden, you're starting to see Russia pay for things with gold. All right, people are now paying for Russian oil with gold. Gold is becoming the currency that Bitcoin was hoping it would be one day. All right, and it's really starting to turn into something that is more tangible than fiat currency. And it gives you a reflection of how people are starting to feel about paper money. All right, they're starting to realize that maybe there's a problem there. So when central banks start to buy gold, you know, that tells you that there is more than just a technical breakout. There's a fundamental shift happening, all right? Whether they believe that there's a debasement that is going to occur or continue to occur. And if that's the case, then you will see them stockpile gold, or they see it as a safe haven and they see huge problems down the road. And I hope that's not the case.
Well, what's your contention? If you had to bet on what you think is driving the move, is it just dollar debasement? Is it the potential for bifurcation, you know, globally between the West and BRICS? Is it because of geopolitical risk? What do you think is driving it?
I think it's all of the above. I really do. I think that probably the biggest driver, though, has been dollar debasement and currency debasement, if you think about it. You know, that is the underlying factor, and history has taught us that. So it's either going to take place in commodities, and commodities are a whole different world these days because of the globalization and the fact that we've got such an amazing global cycle, a yearly cycle now that takes place in commodities. But if you think about commodities back in the old days, all right, and let's use that as an example. Soybeans went from 33 cents a bushel to $4 a bushel from 1935 to 1955. Well, what happened? All right, well, we inflated our way out of a world war, out of a depression, and the market never went back. All right. So what is happening now? We're seeing it happen with gold. Because gold is now that new soybean market, because soybeans were only in the U.S. at that time, only dollar-denominated, only grown here. Well, now they're growing down in South America, they're growing in Egypt, they're growing all over the world. But gold is the real reflection of the debasement story that's been taking place over the course of these last 15 to 20 years.
All right, I want to go back to something you said before about, you know, people not letting the market crash during an election year and just put the tinfoil hat on for a second, only because I know that you know the plumbing of markets a hell of a lot better than I do, and probably most of my listeners do. When you say something like that and you hear somebody, you know, make a statement like that, they won't let it crash during an election year. I know you're probably alluding to the Fed kind of, you know, jawboning the right way to try to give a cushion to sentiment. But do you think that there are other methods at play behind the scenes that prevent the market from getting too volatile? In other words, do you think the market really is rigged behind the scenes?
Well, it's funny, you know, we used to talk about it all the time on the floor. Whenever the market would be getting hit, we'd call it the plunge protection team.
Right.
All right. The PPT would be in, and sure enough, the market would hold at certain levels and then go up. But if you think about it, has it ever been talked about? No. But, you know, central banks intervene in currency markets. Right. We've known that they intervene in the bond markets.
Right.
So why wouldn't they intervene in the equity markets? I mean, you know, and when I say intervene, I'm talking about maybe just being a safety net at times. So if there is a plunge that's taking place, they would be the bid. They would be the House of Morgan during the Depression that steps in and makes the market for U.S. steel, as it were. So, you know, they need to be that person. Do they do it? I don't know. Are there coincidences at play that take place every now and then? Yes. And quite frankly, it would be easy to do because remember, you've got two different regulators at play. You've got the SEC and FINRA on one side. You've got the CFTC on the other. You've got products that are basically the same, whether it's the S&P 500 futures or the SPY. So right. All of that, you know, remember, they could do it a lot of different ways. Here, it's funny. I remember being called into, and I could say it, into the CIA office, and they said, Jack, we're worried about somebody manipulating the matching engine. And I said, okay. They said, well, you know, what should we look for? And I said, well, I said, if I were going to manipulate the matching engine, I wouldn't be looking in my market. They said, what are you talking about? I said, if I were going to manipulate the matching engine, I manipulate the futures and I trade spies.
Right.
Because they're two different markets. All right. And they looked at me and their mouths dropped wide open because they never understood that. So, you know, it's little things like that, the interrelationship between these markets that I think that are very, very key. So getting back to it, I think that what I see right now is a market that doesn't need the plunge protection team or any of those conspiracy theories that I've had in my mind and other traders have had in their minds over the course of the years. But if we get to that 20 or 30% level, Chris, watch and see if we start to see huge bids that are put into the market. All right. And if that's the case, you know, remember, it's like catching a falling knife. Who does that?
Right.
You know, and that's really what will give us the tell.
And there are sharks. There are sharp people that do it. You know what I mean? Like Carl Icahn bought the S&P futures the evening Trump got elected. There are savvy players that step in and make, you know, hang their balls out there and make those moves. So, you know, and they're, the lower the price goes, the more likely you are to find a bid from somebody. So those are good arguments, too. If they did do it, it would be in the index futures or it would be in the index ETFs because they're one of many now tails that kind of wag the dog of market, right? There's no point in going in and putting the Magnificent Seven on your balance sheet when you can just buy the Qs or just buy the NASDAQ futures and everything else adjusts accordingly. You know, if the futures hit a certain level by 4 a.m, that's going to set the opening price for a lot of equities automatically. There's no
Not only that, though, and there's another nuance at play there. Remember, there's a lot of index. There's literally billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars in positions in index arbitrage. All right. And what they will do is, and this is something that people don't understand. So it's kind of hard. It's a nuance of the market. If they deplete their inventory on a sell-off, they can no longer do sell programs. It's very difficult for them to do. So that's why all of a sudden you don't see – it feels like it loses gas. A break will lose gas only because these ARBs have lost their inventory. Now, what will happen on the rally is it doesn't matter to them that it's rallying, but because the spread between futures and cash gets a little wider, they start to do their buy programs again. That fuels the rally back up. So if I'm the Fed, or if I'm somebody who's trying to do exactly what we're talking about, what you do is you deplete. Once you see that the ARBs are depleted, you rally it and take it to a level where they can start adding on and fuel the buy programs back in. So that's what I've seen happen. And again, it's a bit of a nuance to the market, but it's something that's worth watching every now and then.
You know, just before you said, look, you think we're on the precipice of a 20 or 30% correction here. And I agree with you. I think timing the rate hike cycle has been extraordinarily difficult because for 2 years I've been shouting fire because we have this enormous amount of debt outstanding, the likes of which we've never seen before. And we jammed rates higher. So if you look at how we were trying to raise rates in 2018 or 2017, we were doing it at quarter point intervals, and we were doing it over the course of several years. And we know what happened in December 2018. All hell broke loose in markets, and Steve Mnuchin had to be excused from the room for soiling himself and had to call the banks. And then all of a sudden, everybody woke up Christmas Eve morning and their present was the Fed decided to go back to zero and stop the hiking experiment. Now, that happened over the course of 3 years and at very, very measured intervals. What we've seen now over the last 2 years can only be described as a ramming of rates significantly higher. I think they were at 3.25% in December 2018. So we've nearly doubled that. And this, of course, is to fight the inflation problem. They've nearly doubled that, and they've done it in about half the time. And so 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago, as I'm watching this, I'm like, damn, something's going to break, right? But what I didn't make sense of then was there was so much more liquidity in the system that we had a much larger buffer zone in terms of savings and access to credit than we did before. But now, as I'm watching credit card delinquencies tick up to, you know, all-time highs, I'm watching mortgage rates, you know, getting closer to 10% than 5%. I'm watching personal savings completely depleted. I can't help but think that when everything catches up here, 20 or 30% might be a walk in the park. I mean,
yeah, the thing to watch, and this is what I keep telling people, is the 10-year. Keep an eye on the 10-year and the 30, but more importantly, the 10, because that's the part of the curve that the Fed really cannot manipulate. They can do the short end of the curve, but they can't do the long end. And why do I say that? We used to call them the bond vigilantes in the old days, all right? And they were the people that would come in, and you'd start to see them hitting that bond market, especially on the long end, because they were because of what you just described. When the bond market starts to understand that it's that the biggest expenditure on the balance sheet now is going to be servicing the debt, bigger than defense, bigger than anything else, you'll start to see bonds get hit, especially on the long end. That's one of the reasons we've started to see the 10-year doing what it's been doing. I think you're right. I think we see a 5, maybe even 5.5% 10-year before we're done here. And if that's the case, that is going to trigger some serious earthquakes within real estate and other sectors of the economy. So to me, we're on the precipice. You know, you can feel it, all right? But how long will we be here? I don't know. You know, it feels like something can break at any time. Right. But then again, you know what? We could be 2 years early, you know, and if that's the case, it could stay ridiculously overbought for 2 years. So, right. You know, it's like Bitcoin. I look at Bitcoin and you know what? It's either going to go to 1 million or it's going to go to zero. I don't know.
Right.
I mean, I just don't know. People have tried to convince me time and time again. I mean, I played in it a little bit. I made a little bit of money. But to be honest with you, I'm not one of these hodlers. I can't hold because I don't know what it is. You know, I feel like I got, you know, it feels like I put money into a slot machine and made it. You know what I mean? It's pure luck. And now I'm thinking to myself, well, you know what? I hit it once. I'm not going to hit it again. You know, so I don't know. So, but the reality is that when we're talking about how people speculate and the psychology of the markets right now, there is nothing more important than the tenure, than the long end of the yield curve, because that's going to dictate not only the flow of capital into equities, but what the Fed can and can't do. They can't take rates to zero if you've got 5.5 on the 10-year. It just won't happen. They can't. The market won't allow it. See, that's the thing. And so it's going to be a real, it's going to be a fight. And what I worry about is the fact that the Fed has become politicized, and if that's the case, then who knows what can happen over the course of these next few months.
Why is the 10-year the most difficult to manipulate, you said earlier?
Because it's the most widely held. It's held by the entire world, whereas the short end of the curve is the one that basically turns over every 3 months, every year, every 2 years. It's the one that they can manipulate.
So it's the most liquid, essentially.
It's the most liquid. It's the one that you've got everybody. All the Chinese are holding it. All the Saudi Arabians are holding it. You know, that's the fixed income note of choice for the entire world.
Got it. So there's more 10 years out there floating around than there are 30 years, in other words.
Oh, yeah. 30 years used to be the market. Now it's the 10.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, I'm still learning about the bond market, and I've been forced to refresh about, you know, how treasury auctions work and stuff this year because they're having such a huge impact, and I want to watch them so closely because I think I get this feeling that everybody's just kind of sitting around waiting for one of these treasury auctions to fail.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's been some pretty huge tails on a couple of the auctions over the last 6 months that, you know, are leading me to believe that things could get a little weird in the treasury market. I mean, what do you think? Do you watch the treasury market closely or no?
I do. But the one thing that I know about the treasury market is that less than 5% of the people in finance understand the treasury market, which is scary when you think about it. All right. And that's the truth, Chris. Think about that. Less than 5%. That's the going rate. And everyone knows stocks. And as you were talking about it, people, you know, that have been in the market for the last 10 years have seen the stock market go nothing but up and seen a bond market that's gone nothing but down. So, but the reality is that this bond market is poised to do something historical in my mind, all right? And that is create an amazing spread between, say, a 3 or a 5 or a 3 month or a 1 year note and the 10 year. We're going to see a widening of that, and it's going to be, people are going to go, oh, this is good, and I'm going to go, no, it's not, because it's happening for the wrong reasons. And again, I go back to what I call the bond vigilantes. It's something that I didn't make up. It's something that Larry Kudlow used to call them, right? And I still talk to Larry every now and then. I'm on his radio show, and you know, he's asked me to do his TV show every now and then. And he said to me, Jack, what do you think? Are we seeing them coming back? And I said, yeah. It feels like we're starting to see them come back. The bond vigilantes are the ones that keep the Fed up at night.
Well, somebody fucking has to do something, Jack, because the government is out of control, you know, at a time when we should be taking the most measured approach possible to spending. And even if we're not going to cut spending, which I know is very difficult for people, it makes people very uncomfortable. Even if we're not going to do that, we at least have to telegraph that we're going to do it. And they're not even doing that. They are taking the accelerator pedal and they are pushing it down as far as it goes. And they're just redlining our fiscal policy right now. And so at some point, you know, the bond vigilantes or somebody is going to have to take the keys away from Mr. Biden and his merry band of imbeciles in his administration, like Janet Yellen, who doesn't know whether she's coming or going. At some point, somebody has to take the keys away. And it looks as though the Fed's not going to do it because you said they're becoming politicized, right? So is the bond market like the last kind of trapdoor of last result to just say, hey, like, we have to fucking stop. Like, we have to stop.
That's exactly why I brought it up, because that is the one market that has done that in the past.
Right.
It is the one that's actually slapped people in the face and said, stop. You can't keep doing this. You know, I mean, you know, we saw it happen. Look, I was raised during the dark days of Jimmy Carter. Okay, and I became a Reagan Republican because of that, because I saw no future under a 90% tax bracket and all the rest of the garbage and bullshit that we saw under Jimmy Carter, right? But, you know, and all of it was done in the name of progressive liberal politics. Look, you could talk about anything. We could talk about every issue. I see it happening here in education. You know, the public schools in Chicago, and I don't mean to get too political about it, but the public schools in Chicago, you know, are a good example.
You can say whatever you want on this show, Jack.
Well, okay, good. I'm a product of the Chicago public school system. When I was younger, the special student was the one that had special skills.
Right.
All right? He was taken out, maybe put into a gifted program or whatever the case was. Now, the special student is the one that has special needs. Now, I have a special needs niece. I understand that. Mainstreaming might be something that you know, they might want for the special needs child. But what it's done is it's taken education down to its lowest common denominator.
Right.
And that is one of the problems that I have with all of these policies that we're seeing in these blue cities. It does not make sense to me. And, you know, I remember during the pandemic, I turned to my wife and I said, how can you keep kids out of school for a year? This is no good. This is not good. And then what's happened is we saw a bifurcation of education because all the rich people said exactly what I was thinking. All right. No way am I keeping my kids out of school for a year.
Right.
And they got them private tutors or they got them private education to put them into private schools. The public school systems have destroyed education in America. And I'm telling you, it's something that we have to look at as just a fragment. It's a microcosm of the rest of the problems that we're facing here. All right. Hey, we got a migrant issue here in Chicago that is just ridiculous. You know, that they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on migrants. And when they only have to say one thing, we're not a migrant city.
Right.
All right. That's all they got to say.
Well, they just can't. They can't because they're just chicken shit cowards. And this is something I'm writing about this weekend. I'm actually in the midst of writing an article about this as we speak. But the point is, anything that creates a, you know, any level of discomfort at all or gives the impression, you know, these people, they let their emotions and their feelings run their decision making, and logic and common sense just don't even make an appearance. And they are just cowards. They're afraid of making consequential, adult, decisive decisions that may be, you know, best for the long term or even longer term or even the next month instead of the next day term for their state, their city, their municipality, their country. They just can't do it because they can't fathom the fact that they're going to disappoint somebody or someone may hold them out to be, not altruistic enough. They're just cowards, Jack. I don't know how else to put it. And it's everywhere. Well,
they're trying to be everything to everybody.
Exactly.
And they can't do it. And the result is, you know, what we're seeing happen in the financial district of Chicago right now, where you've got a 50% vacancy rate, all right? You've got stores that are closing, and now they want to turn them into residential areas down LaSalle Street. This wonderful mayor of ours has got this brilliant idea to take that area and to turn it into a residential area, the heart of the business section of Chicago. So for any of you that remember LaSalle Street and the Board of Trade and the Merck the way it used to be, well, guess what? Our mayor here in Chicago is going to change all of that, all right? And he's going to turn that into a migrant living shelter. So I am in shock. I really am. But here, look, getting back to it, and I don't mean to dig too deep into it that way, but I'm just telling you what I think is a reflection of
why. And you're an immigrant, you know? It's not like you're this, like, insane, like, crazy right-wing nationalist, like, psycho. Like, you're an immigrant as well. Like, you understand better than anybody the benefits of legal immigration, right?
Well, actually, I'm the son of immigrants. Let's clarify
that. I'm sorry. That's what I meant.
But my parents waited for 7 years. My parents came as refugees to this country, and they waited for 7 years to come to this country. And my father, God bless him, before he died, was absolutely irate because he lived out in California at the illegal immigration that was coming all over the border. His thing was, hey, I had to wait 7 years.
Right.
Why don't they? All right. And if he saw, you know, good thing he's not seeing this, what's going on right now, because this would just drive him insane. But you know, one of the things that I find fascinating, and you just, I don't mean to go off on that tangent, but one of the things I find fascinating is that your biggest wave of immigrants that are coming through California right now are from China.
Yeah.
They're taking first class flights to Mexico City and then getting bused to the border with suitcases. I find that absolutely
wearing Canada Goose jackets and with Louis Vuitton purses, and you know, no, nobody's alarmed. Lots of military aged men coming into the country. Just, you know, Meanwhile, I have to get my fucking balls fondled every time I'm at the TSA if I want to fly from Boston to New York, a 45-minute flight. You know, I got a guy who's got to stick a finger up my ass like he's checking my prostate. These people are just walking. Military-aged foreigners are just walking across the border, and no one. But again, also something I'm writing about. We don't seem to notice it's a problem until it's way too late. And it's the same with markets, right? Nobody thinks the market's going to crash until we're standing on the other side of a 20% intraday move that's breaking records. And everybody's pointing at each other going, hey, Jack, like, how come nobody saw this coming? You know?
Well, it's funny. You've got everybody that's my age, and I'm in my early 60s, all right, that's yelling and screaming. And the younger people that are all maybe, you know, maybe 10 years younger than you or maybe 5 years younger than you are kind of looking at me and going, you're out of your mind.
Right.
You're out of your mind. And I'm thinking to myself, no, I'm not. I've seen this play
before,
guys.
I've just seen some shit. Right, exactly.
You know, so, but for me, again, once the market turns psychologically, it's hard. You're right. I call it, you know, turning an aircraft carrier around in a bay. It leaves a big wake, all right? But once you do it, it's hard to turn it back. And it's something that, you know, when you start to see momentum shift, when we start to see a situation which we started to see, where rallies are failing, we're seeing lower highs and, you know, lower lows. All right. All of that tells me that something is happening. That break the other night, all right, that we saw, that was a 100-handle break in the S&Ps when we thought that there was a war going on. That's a warning signal to me. Yeah. You know, Jesse Livermore wrote in Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, Lefevre wrote that the market gives you warning signals. That was a warning signal. All right. That tells you how vulnerable the market is.
And then they bid that all the way up overnight, Jack. They bid it all the way up after, you know, everyone decided it was a de-escalatory attack. Right. So the same 100 handles, they bid it up. And then when the cash open happened, what happened? They sold the same 100 handles back down. Now, that's a little bit of volatility, right?
It's a lot of volatility. In fact, volatility is one of those precursors to a large event, you know, and that's the other thing that I you know, people need to understand. When you start to see this happen, all right, it's usually followed by a huge move. Now, whether it's up or down, I happen to think it's down. But this volatility is telling you something. It's telling you that the market is scared, is on the edge. And if you start to see the long end of the curve start to work its way higher, like I think it will, that could be what really sets it off.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, especially newer people in the market, don't realize that, you know, the volatility that precedes big moves, it doesn't necessarily always have to be down either. You know, if you're getting a 3% down day and a 2% green day the next day and, you know, 1.5% lower and then 2% higher the next day, that's just not normal market mechanics. That doesn't mean that all is well. And just because there's a couple green days peppered in there doesn't mean like you should ignore it and they cancel each other out. Those are, you know, especially today in a computerized market that I'm convinced is somehow squelching volatility more so than it normally would if this was just a free open market on the floor. Those types of moves are just astronomical. And those, you know, even the swings higher, the volatility higher can, you know, be a precursor to a larger move. I want to ask you, you know, with rates where they are, you're talking again about psychology shifting, right? So let's just say that we get a 20 or 30% move lower here in the markets, and let's say the 10-year, you know, let's say the 10-year goes to over 5.5%, and all of these prognostications that you have come to fruition, and all of a sudden, you know, the mood starts to sour a little bit on the street. And people start realizing what people like you and I have been talking about forever, which is this is an unprecedented kind of path that we've come down. You know, looking back and seeing how far down this odd path we've gone really puts into perspective just how far off the path we've come, I guess. And when we look back on that, given the predicament that the Fed is in now and likely will still be in, even in the event of a crash will probably be somewhat deflationary, but let's just say, you know, inflation is still at 3% when that happens. What would be the next waypoint you would see that would be the beginning of psychology shifting bullish again? Because for me, it becomes very difficult to ram that change down people's throats if you don't have the ability to do significant quantitative easing again. And, you know, like, what do you think will happen? Do you think the Fed will ease into in an inflationary environment with inflation at 3%? I mean, people argue that they would have to, but I mean, that would just be catastrophic. I mean, or do you think we just go dark? We just have dark days for 10 years or 20 years like Japan?
I think it depends on who is president. If we see another 4 years of Joe Biden, we could see a serious issue and serious problems. We're not going to see spending slow down. We're going to see this hole that we're digging get deeper and deeper. If we get, and I don't care if it's Trump or any Republican administration, if we get a conservative fiscal administration in office, that can change things. That's what we need. We need fiscal restraint. That's the problem. Monetary policy can only do so much. Right. We've seen this, all right? We need to show fiscal restraint. We have been spending money like drunken sailors. We have been giving money away. I mean, you know, how many billions of dollars in student loans, you know, has this president written off with our tax dollars? You know what I mean? Why not just create a 1%, you know, a fund for anybody that wants to borrow to go to college? I don't understand what they're doing and why they're doing it the way they are. They created this problem. In fact, it was Joe Biden that was part of the legislation that didn't allow for bankruptcies. All right. You could not take your student loans off of your bankruptcy. How about that? All right. You were still tied to those. That was his doing when he was a senator. So, you know, and I remember that distinctly at the time. You know, I used to go out to Washington and I used to lobby on behalf of the CME. All right. I was a board of director. And I got to tell you something. I have got a very bitter taste in my mouth for a lot of these politicians. I used to call it legalized extortion because they would hold their hand out and tell me that there was going to be a transaction tax. Didn't matter what party they were with. All right. Because they expected a donation from our PAC. OK, that's who we're dealing with. That's the lawmakers that we have out there right now. And it's gotten no better over the course of the last 20 years. So, you know, for me, these are the people that are trying to create a fiscal policy that makes sense when they have no idea. All right. Half of them have never even been in the real world. OK, they've only been politicians, you know, their entire lives. They don't understand. They don't understand the mechanics, the structure of the marketplace, of the free markets. So, you know, all of that is starting to come to boil right now. All right. We're starting to see it. You're seeing a president that's never really done anything but be a politician, a vice president that was really nothing more than a lawyer. And, you know, she wasn't even a good one at that. OK. You know, you've got the administration around her. You got a joke for a press secretary. I mean, it's getting to the point where, you know, look at the military. Look at the head of the military. I'm afraid for my children because of what I'm seeing. And that to me, you know, is indicative of how Americans that are my age that have kind of turned their backs on Biden feel.
Right.
All right. You know, look, do people like me love Trump? Do they consider themselves MAGA people? No. I've got a lot of friends that are not big Trump fans. Look, I've met the man. I'm not his biggest fan, okay? But guess what? I've met Biden, and I think I'm less of a fan of his.
Hey, at least Trump can balance his checkbook, not meaning that he does, but he has the capability to. You know what I mean? I'm just not sure that, like, you know, I think the private sector experience goes a very long way, because you can say what you want about him stiffing his vendors and about being a prick and all the things, but at least he understands how the gears turn in the private sector. And I think that already puts him light years ahead of anybody. I mean, you watch some of these House Financial Services Committee's meetings and hearings, and you see these people, I forget what I was watching, but Jamie Raskin reading from some paper, maybe he was talking about student loans, I don't remember, a couple weeks ago. But you can see he's reading what somebody handed him, and he doesn't understand the topic of what he's talking about. And it's the same when you listen to one of these Democratic politicians talk about monetary policy or talk about spending. They don't really know. They don't know how to balance a checkbook. I mean, no. They just don't. They don't understand what a balance sheet is. They don't know that you know, underconsumption is what allows for savings, and overconsumption is what creates deficits. I mean, these are, like, first off, things people should be learning in second grade when you learn, you know, a dime is 10 cents, a quarter is 25 cents, doing those exercises. But, yeah, what does he say in Stand and Deliver? You know, just fill the hole, you know, like you dig a negative plus a negative equals a positive, you know, like just fill the hole. I say, just fill the hole, you know.
Well, you know, I love this. I love this whole move about making the minimum wage $20 for fast food workers out in California. And now people are surprised that they're closing shops up. All right, or going to automation. I see. It's things like that you know what you can see where they don't understand the economics of things. All right?
Right.
You know, I saw a story the other day where they're going to make it illegal to close a store, a grocery store in San Francisco. All right, if the neighborhood needs that store, what's that tell you? Are you going to nationalize the chain? How are you going to keep it to stay open? I don't understand that.
They don't understand. They don't know what that will do to the business. And they don't know how a business will react to that, probably by, you know, understaffing it and putting less products in it and just getting it to a point where it's generally miserable so that the community demands it's closed. But, like, they don't understand the consequences of that. They think that they think their job is to plan the economy. And I can't think of a more, you know, just wholly incorrect and counterintuitive way to think than that. I mean,
well, if anybody listened to what Jamie Dimon said in Davos, he actually said something that was very, very interesting. Basically what he said was, look, I'm not a big Trump guy, but everything he said was right. Everything he's been talking about and said about immigration, about interest rates, about taxes, he's been right. You know, and it almost pained Jamie Dimon to say that. You know what I mean? And what he was saying was, you know, essentially, listen, you know, just because you don't like the guy doesn't mean that what he was saying was wrong.
Right.
And that's one of the things that I've been trying to, you know, come to grips with a lot of my friends. All right. But the reality is that the 4 more years of Biden is not doable. All right. We can't see this type of spending continue. And if we do, we're going to see rates just continue to go up, Chris. It's going to be it could be a catastrophe in my mind. All right. In my mind's eye, I'm starting to see Jimmy Carter. I'm starting to see a stock market that really struggles. And you want to talk about 10 years of lost dead money? Right. That's what you could see. All right. That's really what I worry about. More importantly, worse than that, what I worry about is a deflationary spiral that's caused by that, all right? And that is something that we could spend another hour talking
about. How would that play out?
That would play out like 1990s Japan, where we saw the Nikkei go from 39,000 down to 9,000, where you saw real estate get quartered, and you saw nothing but zombie banks. How do I know? I was an officer at Nikko Securities at the time. I saw it happen, all right? I watched at slow motion train crash taking place. And a lot of it was because of spending. A lot of it was because of the ignorance of government and the way they were treating things. And we just saw the markets just react accordingly.
What would that look like in the U.S.? What would catalyze it and kind of what would go first? And just give me the 30,000 foot, what would happen?
We would start to see a break here really hard. You'd start to see the Fed act, take rates back down to zero. The long end would not react. It would stay higher. You'd see the stock
market. You'd see it in equities first, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, got it. Go ahead.
Yes. That would be the trigger. All right. You'd see the Fed act on that. We'd see a widening, a very, very steep a yield curve, and then of course the market would just continue to disintegrate. All right, real estate would get clobbered. You would see zombie banks that you'd have to see mergers of all of your regional banks. All right, because we are overbanked here in the U.S. That's the bottom line. So that's going to eventually, and the trigger for that, we're probably going to see a little of that happen with commercial real estate over the course of these next 4 months, 5 months, because there's going to be a lot of resets taking place. But that is, in my mind's eye, one of the worst scenarios. Now, why do I bring that up? Because I just got through writing a paper on AI. And how AI could be the most disinflationary invention we have ever come up with in our lives, in human history. It could replace every job we can think of in one way or another. It can end up creating structural unemployment. And what did we have in Japan during the 90s? Structural unemployment, an entire decade of people that did not work and lived at home. So these are the things, you know, that keep me up at night, that I worry about when I'm looking at the market condition. And hopefully, you know, it won't happen.
Well, and the proposed solution to anything that you're talking about would just be more problem. You know, in a case where everybody winds up unemployed, the government's first thought is going to be, we need to create jobs out of thin air so that we can say that people have jobs. And of course, it will be something counterintuitive that generates no productivity and costs money. And, you know, as I'm writing this weekend, we always have to exercise all of the wrong solutions. And I mean all of them before we get to the one lowly remaining solution, which happens to be closer to the correct solution. But really, we'll exhaust everything before we do that. I think, you know, I guess there's two more things I want to ask you, and then I'll let you slide. I appreciate you taking time this morning. The first is, you know, when you look at the conundrum the Fed's in, are they more inclined to allow inflation to continue to run hot? Are they more inclined to stay higher for longer? And which direction do you think they would move in if the market starts to get volatile? Do you think they would just capitulate and start to cut rates into higher inflation now? Or do you think Powell will try to hold his ground?
The economist in Powell would want to hold his ground. The politician in Powell is going to have to cut rates. I think that's the simple answer. All right. Because the right thing to do for an economist, all right, is to be to hold fiscal restraint right here. Right. Right? To make sure that we're tight. But they're more than politicians or more than the economists. They're politicians. So I've got a feeling that even though we see inflation hot, we're going to start to see him doing something that pleases, you know, the public opinion.
All right. And the last thing I want to ask you, and this may take a minute or two of explaining, but is there a way that you can put into simple terms for my listeners the mechanics of a treasury auction and what people should be watching for when they see the bid to cover, when they see, you know, the when issued and the high yield of the auction, and when they see auctions across different maturities, kind of what some of those things mean? Because I know they'll post the results of treasury auctions. I think they're at 2:00 Eastern. And usually what you see is you see a bid to cover, you see a when issued, you see a high yield, and you see either a stop through or a tail. And those are, there's very simple financial explanations for all those things that most people that understand the stock market can understand easily. It's just a different, it's cloaked in a little bit different jargon. And I'm wondering if you could just take a minute or two to explain to my listeners what they should be looking for and what some of the signs are would be in cracks.
Gotcha. Let's take it from the beginning. So the way the auction works is that you've got these prime dealers that basically bid on whatever the U.S. is offering so that they can end up funding for the period that they're auctioning off for, whether it's a 3-month, a 5-year, 10-year, whatever the case is. So now you have these dealers actually put in and start to trade that market before it even comes out. That's why they have that what called a when issued market. So now they've actually got an idea of what that is going to go off at. Now it's really a question of what the demand
is. It's an auction before an auction, right?
It's an auction before an auction. It's almost like when you see an IPO taking place and they'll tell you, oh, the bid is this, the offer is this. They really haven't seen
any trades
yet.
Right.
The indications, exactly. So then, of course, the auction takes place. Now you see the actual demand from these dealers, what they have, who's coming in, their customer base, whether it's an endowment fund. It could be a sovereign wealth fund. It could be another central bank from another government. They come in through that dealer and they'll create this demand for that product. So what will happen is now we'll find out what the demand is. So if they've got $30 billion to auction off, what if the demand is only there for $27 billion? Well, okay, well, then that other $3 billion, you're going to start to see a bit of a tail, right? Because all of a sudden, you're going to start to see people back off a little bit, and they're going to average in, and they're going to make a market for you, but it's going to be a little higher. So that is essentially the mechanics of it. Now, what to watch for?
And what's the size of the when issued versus the size of – so the pre-auction auction.
There really isn't – you know that it's going to be a $30 billion auction, okay, as a dealer. But you're trading – so you're trading – it and trying to get a price for it, but you don't know what the demand is going to be for it.
Right.
You see what I mean? So you get an idea of price. So, okay, now are we going to see this price actually play out? All right. And that's usually when we start to see the tails take place. And that's usually what you have to pay for. And if you mentioned it a little while ago about a failed auction, that's when you start to see failed auctions. All right. So, for example, if we're going to auction off $30 billion in 10-year notes and there's only $20 billion in demand for it, they might cancel that auction. Now, if you ever hear that happen, or if you hear of an auction failing, that's when you've really got to get on your toes and be very, very careful. That's the kind of thing that can hit money market funds, equity funds, bond markets. It could hit across the board. So it's the one of those things where people have been real blasé about it. You know what I mean? They've talked about the tail. They've talked about – no one's talked about a failed auction.
No, nobody has. People talk about – you know, they talk about tails that are increasing in size and bid to covers that aren't – where historically they've been, but nobody's actually talked about them failing.
Right. And that's, so if there is ever a trigger, if there's ever somebody that I would say, if there's one thing for the average layman, the investor to pay attention to more than anything else, all right, is if we see a failed auction. The predecessor to that would be if we start to see these tails get longer and longer and the bids to cover get worse and worse.
So the a tail on an auction, again, means that the pre-auction auction, basically what everybody guesses the auction is going to price at, they wind up overshooting the mark. They wind up
Right.
Yeah, they wind up saying, hey, we're going to be able to, you know, sell them for 10, and when the real bid comes in, they're only selling them for 8. And the difference there, the spread between the guess, essentially, and the actual once the demand comes in, the wider that gets, the longer the options, the wider the auction's tail is. And so in terms of size, in terms of basis points, what do you look for as signs of, you know, small cracks versus real distress in
well, I think it's more consistency of them happening. That's really what you want to pay attention to, because if they continue to happen, because remember, we're talking about a lot of supply that we're putting on the market, all right? And if that demand continues to shrink, well, then we're going to see serious problems. You're going to see higher interest rates because of it. I mean, it's just a simple supply and demand theory, and it's the part of the curve that the Fed really can't do anything about unless they basically go in there and expand that balance sheet once again and start to buy 10 years, which is going to be a real hard do if they want to do that.
Right. And a stop through is just the opposite of a auction tail, meaning that things went better than expected when the actual demand came in. So
it's more demand than there was auction for, there was product.
Right. So you'll know right away, you know, a tail generally means that, you know, the guess kind of missed, and a stop through means that the auction did better than expected. And just explain what a bid to cover is real quick and how kind of looking back historically at those numbers can give you an idea of how an auction performs.
Well, basically, that's all part of the tail. So, you know, your bid to is really what you're bidding on the product for. How much more than that bid is necessary, all right, for you to be able to buy the product is really what it comes down to. Or less is really what it comes down to. So your bid to cover is basically your spread between your when issued and your actual play.
All right, Jack. Hey, man, thank you so much for breaking that shit down for us on a weekend morning and taking time for me really early. It's nice having coffee together and talking about the end of the world, man. Hopefully get to see you on CNBC a little bit. When was the last time you were on CNBC?
You know what? I quit doing CNBC only because it's kind of hard to go downtown every day. And more importantly, I'm now old and white, and they don't like that. And male, let me put it that way.
You got to pull your son of immigrants card, you know? That's
But now I'm working on my other things. We just created our data exchange, Chris. We're really excited about that. We figured out a way to be able to monetize people's data that it's on their books. Corporations will be able to actually create an asset that is locked right now on their books and be able to trade it like a commodity.
And what's your website for that in case people want to go and check out your new project?
It's smartxdata.com.
Just like it sounds, S-M-A-R-T, the letter X, data.com?
That's right.
All right, beautiful. And I'll put that in my podcast description. And one other thing before you go, I'll also put your Twitter in my podcast description. And I will put my favorite where, you know, I must mention, it's obligatory now every time you're on, my favorite clip of you from the PBS documentary where they were following open outcry traders and you're screaming, screaming at the top of your lungs on the floor in Chicago. And I will put that YouTube clip in there so you can, everybody can see Jack Borugin in action in his prime, wearing the GOP label on his jacket.
Well, I was stuck on a five lot, which was a $50,000 trade at the time because of the way the NASDAQ was working at 100 points. So when you see me acting that way, there's a reason for it. That was a $50,000 yell is what that was.
All right, Jack. Thanks so much, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. You too, Chris.
All right. The one, the only, Mr. Jack Borugin. Awesome to have him on and get his thoughts on things and, you know, help us understand bond auctions and all the other bullshit that, you know, we're too busy mostly drinking beer to try to figure these things out. All right, fools, listen, it's Sunday morning. What am I going to do? Am I going to post this today? I think I might. You know, we just posted Spiegel last week, but I feel like we want to get this one out before tomorrow. So maybe I'll get this thing ready to roll and then I'll go do my workout. But all right. Check out my sponsors if you enjoyed it. JM Bullion for gold and silver bullion. My friends at Swan Bitcoin get $10 free using the link in my podcast description. And my good buddy George Gammon, who will be on soon, over at Rebel Capitalist Pro. God, the Sixers looked like shit last night. All right, fools, I'm out of here. Peace.